Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 337. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. Very excited to be back. I have with me Jim Cassidy, who is the pastor of Calvary OPC in Ringgoes, New Jersey, soon to be planting a church, though, in Austin, Texas, with the Presbytery of the Southwest, mainly from the church there in Pflugerville, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to speak with you.
Good to be here, as always, Camden.
We also have with us Adam York. Very pleased to welcome him back. He's the pastor of Providence OPC in Kingwood, Texas. It's in the northeastern area of Houston. Welcome back, Adam. It's good to speak with you as well.
Hi, brothers. Good to be here. Looking forward to receiving Jim down here in short order.
Yes.
We'll be headed our way.
Joining the central time zone, as we mentioned, should make recordings with me a little bit easier
Something to be really proud of. I'm looking forward to it.
In the great state of Texas.
Being in the right time zone.
The nation
right
state.
Zone, that's the important thing.
The only state in the union that used to be its own country, at least as far as I remember.
May yet once again become its own country. Who knows?
Still looking forward to that day.
Already not yet, once again. Well, we have a very important conversation today, one that's going to strike right at the heart of many historical issues as well as current debates and discussions on confessional subscription. To do that, we're going to speak with the Reverend Alan Strange, who is professor of church history at Mid-America Reformed Seminary in Dyer, Indiana, as well as associate pastor at New Covenant OPC in Joliet, Illinois. Welcome to the program, Alan. It's great to have you.
It's good to be with you, brothers.
Well, Alan has completed all the work and all the defenses, and he's gotten through all the reviews, including a national review at the University of Wales for his PhD. He has had a successful defense. We want to congratulate him and also say that he is soon to be the Reverend Dr. Alan Strange. So congratulations, Alan. We're wonderful to have you on the other side of all of this work.
Thanks.
We're very excited to speak to him today. We're going to be speaking about the animus impenitentis, which is a feature. It's a feature of legal. It's a legal term, the Latin term, and we're going to open up that and discuss what it means to subscribe to a document and what it means for something to be governing for a body in terms of their beliefs and practices. Before we open that complicated subject up and what it means for you and for us today, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and viewers to help us produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. Please visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. We're very encouraged by all the support that we receive. It's wonderful to see all the names and the people that have partnered with us, especially on a monthly basis. And we do encourage you to do so and join with all of those who are helping us to do our work. We love supporting you, and more than that, supporting the church by offering helpful Reformed theological resources that will help you understand the teaching of the Bible and support you in your faith there. So visit us online today. We want to thank everybody for their support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, Alan, it's important here that I think we speak about our terms, especially since we're talking Latin. We don't have our brother Jeff Waddington here to correct my pronunciation, but we do have before us an important Latin phrase, the animus imponentis. What is that? What is its pedigree, and how does it apply here to Presbyterians today?
Well, I agree, Camden. It's a mouthful. Yeah, we often, in some of the writing I've done, abbreviated AI, which of course for some means artificial intelligence, and for others of us, that's the only hope we have for any intelligence. At any rate, it's an old legal term, you could think of it this way, or you know, look it up in Black's Law Dictionary.
Yes,
we'll give you a little guidance there. Animus is, you may recall, your high school Latin, as they say, means the mind or the intention, and the imponentis is the body that imposes something. In this case, the standards, we might say, the Westminster Standards. So the animus imponentis, just as this old term used particularly, it brought into sort of ecclesiastical usage in the 19th century. It had been used at broader law and civil context, and it refers to the intention of the imposing body. The idea being here that whatever one may mean when one takes an oath, what you should have in mind is not simply some personal private meaning that might even be at variance with the plain words of the oath or what you know the body imposing it means or thinks by the oath. You shouldn't have some personal meaning over against what you understand the imposing body to mean and to understand by that oath. So there's lots of ways you can get at this. One of the things that I've tried to stress as I've dealt with this, as I've sort of tried to expose this issue and to bring it to the attention of some, is that some see this as a novel sort of thing, and they want to pit animus impotentis over against something like the original intent of, say, the framers of the Westminster Standard. So you've got what they may have meant that could be gathered from the debates themselves, and, you know, particularly in recent years, Chad Van Dixhorn has given us a lot more light on those debates. Are their writings, their letters, their sermons, things that they would produce? And so there are a number of things that you could look at to gauge what might their intent have been. But animus impotentis is saying there's not only that factor, and it's not seeking to dismiss that. That's an important feature. But how then has the church as a corporate body over the course of years read this document? How do they understand this document? Does the church, for example, understand, does the OPC, of which we're all a part, for example, does it understand in chapter 21, for example, is that restricting the use in worship of music to, strictly speaking, psalmody? Is that what's going on there in chapter 21 on religious worship? When it talks about singing of psalms with grace in the heart, does that mean we may sing psalms and only psalms? We may sing nothing but psalms. Well, we can talk about the original intent there. And just to say this, I don't think that question is as open and shut as some people think it is, even with respect to the Westminster Assembly. But that aside, whatever the Westminster Assembly means when it says this, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church has historically, there's been a minority that's argued here and there for exclusive psalm singing, but the significant majority of the church has not confessed or practiced exclusive psalm singing, nor have they understood Westminster Confession of Faith 21:5 to require such, so that when a man comes before the presbytery, for example, and is being examined, and he's asked, does he scruple at anything in the Westminster Confession? Is there that in the Westminster Confession with which he is not able to concur as a matter of doctrine? If he says, well, I don't believe that we're required to sing only psalms, though you might interpret 21:5 that way, what I've often seen happen in several presbyteries is a response given along these lines, well, we don't interpret it that way. And that phrase right there is showing you what is meant then by this mysterious thing called the animus impotentis. That's an expression of it. That's an expression of this animus impotentis, because right there you have a body saying, maybe the moderator is saying this, maybe the clerk is saying this. He's saying, well, historically we've not required people or we've not regarded this as a scruple, and we've not required people to express it as such. We don't interpret, in other words, 21:5 as we read it, as requiring exclusive psalmody. So there's the animus impotentis. And I say all of that to say, Camden, that some brothers among us, and I understand this, and I do, and I want to be sensitive to it and account for it, get very nervous when they hear this, the adducement of this phrase, animus infinitus, and they think that something is being monkeyed with, that this is being pitted against the original intent, that we're trying to change the confession without changing it, without amending it. You know, we're just sort of informally changing it. The fact of the matter is, though, there is an animus infinitus, whether we like it or not. In other words, the body, the presbytery that's examining a man, has a way they read the confession corporately. That's just a fact. Now, that animus infinitus could be in a declining church. It could be liberalizing. So the animus infinitus itself, it, as a term and as a description, doesn't say whether something is good or bad. You could say the animus infinitus of the mainline church, of the PCUSA. I mean, you see what they did in 67, of course, the Book of Confessions. But the animus infinitus is, in a general way, anything goes. Well, none of us here think that's a good approach. We don't agree with that. But the fact of the matter is there is a corporate reading of the confession in some fashion or another, and the body tends to have some view of how we read this. Is this a scruple? Is this not a scruple?
Yeah, we definitely see that things are a lot more complicated than some would imagine at the beginning, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're hopeless or that we just kind of fly by the seat of our pants either.
Absolutely.
So we're talking here, right. We want to understand that there are many different layers here. Certainly if somebody came and read the standards with a Kantian mindset, they could do almost anything they want with it. That's not what we're speaking about here, but we have the Westminster documents, and we're using them as an example here of the animus infinitus in action, because those are the confessional documents of many of our listeners, by far not the most, but certainly we'll use them as a prime example. So we have the original documents being written and adopted in the 17th century, but then we have another layer. We can talk historically about the Adopting Act in 1729, in which the American Church decided to use these as our governing standards. We also have, at least in our denomination, which began in 1936 at the Second General Assembly, we adopted those standards. So what original intent do we mean? Do we mean the people that wrote it? Do we mean the body that said this is the official document? Do we mean the American Church when it was first adopted? Do we mean the beginning of our denomination? Do we mean when our presbytery was formed? There are whole layers of complexity that are involved here that certainly touch upon hermeneutical issues, as well as a whole host of other things. So where do we go here, Alan? You know, clearly, I think as exclusive psalmody is a good example. Maybe some of the Westminster Assembly intended that to mean exclusive psalmody. And that's a more obvious today that that's not what the OPC or what a majority of Reformed denominations or people in practice would believe. At what point do we recognize, you know, this is, you know, what the body has intended? How do we go about discerning what that intent is?
Yeah, well, I think you're quite right that there are these layers even to the question of original intent. And I'm making a bit of a distinction originally or in my sort of opening comments here. I made a bit of a distinction.
Yes.
Between original intent on the one hand and animus infinitus on the other hand. But ultimately, as
that's
you would gather, original intent is sort of then is folded in a sense, and becomes a part of animus infinitus insofar as a body would care about original intent. But let me say this about original intent. With respect to, say, the Westminster Assembly of Divines, it's very important to realize that the Westminster Assembly of Divines as such was not an ecclesiastical body. And they did not on their own determine anything. They were a body advisory to the Parliament of England in a situation in which Erastianism prevailed. That is, you had the sort of in reaction, you might say, to the medieval assertion of the Roman Catholic Church that the church was over the state. Much of the Reformation picked up some of those strands from old Caesaropapism and said, no, properly, the state is over the church. Now, the reformers all understood that both church and state are properly under God. But Erastianism, that the state is over the church, was really at that time under Charles I and Laud, who was just in process of, you know, had been impeached, Archbishop Laud. Things are going forward there. England is in rebellion against the king, Charles I, and the Parliament calls this body, which begins meeting July 1, 1643, which we call the Westminster Assembly of Divines, but really they're a grand committee of theologians, ministers and theologians, who meet together to advise the Parliament. Originally to revise the 39 articles and the liturgy and so forth of the Church of England. And then very shortly thereafter in September, as they're talking with the Scots and they come in and you have the Solemn League and Covenant, you have now a new body constituted in the sense that they're going to draft a form of government, a directory for worship, a new confession. But all of this is advisory. And the English, in the English context, it's never adopted by the English church. It's adopted by the Scottish church. So you could say that the Scottish church, in adopting it in the late 1640s, actually their original intent is the real original intent in some ways, but that's all quite arguable how that all, the particular relationship between those things. But just as you say, then there are these other layers of original intent, and that all goes into ultimately then shaping what we understand the animus to be, to read, how do we read all of this? Mm-hmm. And just back to the Westminster Assembly for a moment. It's also the case, even if you look at the writings of the divines, whether it's personal correspondence or public sermons or lectures or treatises, when you look at all of that and you see a distinct position that the divines have adopted, or a lot of them have a particular position on something, it's often the case that at Westminster, even though a number of them, perhaps even a majority of them, may have a position on something in common, that when it comes to expressing what they do and expressing as they do in the Westminster Confession of Faith and the catechisms, they do so in a rather more muted fashion. They will often express something. Take, for example, eschatology. You look at the last two chapters of the Westminster Confession of Faith and compare it with the writings of some of the divines. They have very distinct and in some cases highly developed views of eschatology. Well, why is what they finally decide to confess together about eschatology, why is it so trimmed back? It's so trimmed back because they think this is the essential thing they want to confess, and they don't want to make a lot of other more particular kinds of pronouncements to have this weight and authority of saying this is what we confess together. And this is true of all sorts of things. Take the creation issue, which is something that I sort of came into this discussion on. We can talk a little bit about that, how that all worked. But I came into this discussion particularly back in more than a decade ago with respect to creation. A number of things had been written saying that the original intent of the divines was, David Hall particularly had written in this area, and it said it was clear that the divines intended to prescribe, when they spoke of the days of creation in the space of 6 days, everything being made in the space of 6 days, that they intended those days to be understood as ordinary days, and that they intended to prescribe that view and to proscribe every other view. Well, as I looked at the debates and all of that, it is the case, it appears to be the case, that most of the divines who chose to write on this did seem to have what we might call an ordinary day view in terms of the length of the days. But I was struck with the fact of how they kept this language in the space of 6 days, which is something they pick up from the Irish articles back in 1615 of of Archbishop Usher, who was appointed as a Westminster divine but didn't attend because of his loyalty to the king. And they picked up that language from the Irish Articles, which picked it up from Calvin. And Calvin, of course, when he speaks of in the space of 6 days, is responding over against Augustine, who taught that, as we all know, that creation as to its duration was instantaneous. It was an instantaneous act. And no, Calvin says he's not comfortable, as I'm not either, with that kind of spiritualizing, as Augustine was wont to do, with the creation account. And he said, no, there's clearly it's portrayed here as in time and given over this period of time in the space of 6 days. So that's over against Augustine's instantaneous creation view. That gets picked up by Archbishop Usher in 1615, which gets picked up at the Westminster Assembly. And one of the things that Hall and some others argued, when some have said, well, they didn't say 6 24-hour days, the argument has been, well, they didn't even have that sort of way of speaking. They wouldn't speak of 24-hour days. But in the research that I did, and I kept researching, not just on this question, but more broadly to see, well, did they ever use that terminology for some reason? Well, in fact, when they were debating the question of the duration of the seventh day, which, of course, Lightfoot, the great Hebraist, thought very distinctly that the seventh day was eternal. And they had quite a debate over that, over the nature of the seventh day. And there was a motion introduced that would define the seventh day quite explicitly as a 24-hour day. This motion was defeated, but it was recorded that such a motion was introduced and defeated. All of which then is to say that they did have at their disposal, they did have in their arsenal, the language of 24-hour days. So I just thought that was interesting with respect to the question of original intent, because so many people have argued they never would have invoked that kind of language. That's our way of speaking. They didn't speak that way. Well, in fact, they did speak that way.
Then the second question is, you know, well, is that what your church believes in terms of, you know, as a body, has it adopted the confession with that understanding? And that's what this conversation is all about.
Right.
Original intent's one thing, and it's absolutely important. Well, it's very important, but it doesn't solve the question entirely.
Right. And let me just say, just to follow briefly, with respect to that question, how animus impotentis is at play in the question of the length of creation days, it is the case then, subsequently, that in American Presbyterianism, when this became an issue, which is largely in the 19th century, and then moving up to the foundation or the formation of the OPC, June 11, 1936, and this, of course, the Second Assembly is in November of that same year, all the time, all that we have recorded there in terms of American Presbyterianism, even when there were lots of debates over theistic evolution and other kinds of debates over vast ages, day-age views of the days, it was simply the case that none of these bodies, none of these, certainly not the General Assembly, the PCUSA, or of the OPC, or presbyteries, so restrictedly said these may only be understood to be 6 24-hour days. Everyone must adopt this exegetical position, which I would argue it is an exegetical position. That's the way they've regarded it. And you're exegeting that particular scripture, and
we hope so
together with other scriptures.
Sure.
But what I mean by that is it wasn't understood to rise to the level that the narrow question of the duration of the days, of the creation days, wasn't understood to arise to a doctrinal level in that sense. That wasn't seen to in any negative way impact the overall doctrine of creation. Creation is an extraordinarily important doctrine. We all believe that. And we all want to affirm it. And we want to affirm a number of very explicit things, including the basic historicity of the first 11 chapters of Genesis and the historicity of Adam. Let's be clear on that, everybody. And I don't just mean Adam York, of course, we believe in him too, but of our first father, which we all know there have been some in our own circles, there have been defections with respect to that in recent years. We know about that and would oppose that. It's very, very important. So, but these things have been understood in these ways. And the animus impenitus, in other words, the way that General Assemblies and presbyteries have handled this in the 19th and 20th century, was not to make the specific question of the duration of the days. Now, other questions were, does Adam's body have animal ancestry? The OPC has said no. It's said no to a variety of sorts of things. But with respect to the question of the duration of the days, it has said there is some permissible liberty with understanding the precise nature of that. And it's not been, we've also not been dogmatic about the age of the earth. There are other things along those lines about which we have not been dogmatic historically. And of course, I talk about this in some of the work you've read. Just to reference this, if people are wanting to look at the where this can be found, in the minutes of the 71st General Assembly, which is 2004, that assembly is where the creation, the Committee on Creation Views gave its report. And the whole report is contained in those minutes. I was the chairman of that committee. I'm grateful to this day for how the Lord led us. We were quite a diverse group in terms of our views of the specific question of the length of the days. I really saw my job as things developed on that committee as bringing as much harmony and as would be possible and dealing as charitably as possible with each other. Could we bring a unified report instead of a lot of minority reports? And we brought a unified report. Now, I know some people don't interpret that as necessarily a good thing. I still think it is to this day a good thing. Mm. And I'm thankful for what the Lord. I'll never forget, we ended up all of our meetings in Orlando. John Meether was one of the members of the committee, and John is in Orlando. And we would also meet in Dyer, but for some reason, they never wanted to meet in Dyer in January or February. I don't understand it. Yeah. But we were down in Florida sensibly. We would meet out in Escondido in California because Brian Estelle and some brothers out there, Brian's a professor at Westminster, California, was on the committee. And as I say, John Meether was on the committee down at Orlando. We met down there and we finished this up. And we had a sense that this was, we almost just automatically rose and sang the doxology together at the end of our work. And it was really heartening to see these brothers of different exegetical views quite sharply put in our meetings at times. I know that seems hard to believe with open men, but you know, contending for the truth as we understand it, but yet being able to stand together, it was wonderful. Thing, and I'm very thankful for it to this day. And so that was where that was first set forth. And I also dealt with the question of animus impenitus in an article that I wrote in the Confessional Presbyterian in 2008, which was called "The Affirmation of the Imputation of the Active Obedience of Christ at the Westminster Assembly of Divines." And I dealt with I was then on the Justification Committee, next committee, and dealt with the question of that the animus impenitus. I brought this into the discussion. In other words, how has the OPC, and particularly the OPC, how have we interpreted that question of the imputation of the active obedience of Christ in our justification? And the animus impenitus is very much at issue there. How do we understand it? So I've been talking about the creation. This isn't something made up to deal with the creation issue, folks. Listeners, let me just assure you, this is not some kind of trick to, you know, get the camel's nose under the tent. We're describing a kind of sociological and historical reality in the church. The church reads the confession in some way. And so it's read it as, you know, the question is, does the Westminster Confession explicitly require does it teach the imputation of the active obedience of Christ. And so you can read that article for that. John Fesco had also, in a much earlier article in the Westminster Theological Journal, back around 2001, dealt with this question as regarding the creation days. But he dealt with some other issues there, Emeraldianism, for example, and he treats these. In other words, what was said at Westminster, but how the church has understood that. Because as you are aware, Emeraldianism are the doctrine of the definite atonement, the sort of third point, if you want to order it that way, of the 5 points of Calvinism, so-called, if you want to order it that way. That particular doctrine isn't explicitly affirmed in the Westminster Confession. And there's, you know, you can read John, his dissertation, I believe, on that. But you can read about that. But of course, if anybody came into our judicatories these days, if anybody came into before an OP presbytery said, I don't believe in limited atonement, definite atonement. Well, everybody who is writing and doing whatever they're doing, playing video, no, nobody would be doing it. But whatever people are doing, you can be assured heads would pop up. He's got everybody's attention now if he's denying this. And if he goes on to argue, and it's an argument, because B.B. Warfield, you know, in his work on the Westminster Assembly, makes a pretty good argument that it in other ways affirms it. I think he makes some good arguments. John Fesco thinks that he over-argues, and that's all an academic debate, obviously. But whatever the case may be, one could say, well, the Westminster doesn't clearly affirm this, but we do. I mean, I don't know of an OP presbytery that would just blithely say, well, you can deny the fact that Christ's death secures the salvation of those who are his. It's a definite, clear matter. So that's just another illustration. There are various illustrations of where the animus impotentis is at issue among us. And it really has to do with the fact that we're living, breathing bodies, presbyteries. Now we're particularly talking about, and the reason I'm mentioning presbyteries especially is they're the bodies that in the first place examine and credential ministers. So that's sort of the first place. But obviously, there's a broader sense of this with respect to the whole denomination. By the way, that article then on imputation of active obedience was also a form of that was republished. That article I said that was in the Confession of Presbyterian was republished in a book edited by Haken and Jones, Drone into Controversy, that if any of your readers are millionaires, they can buy it.
Indeed.
It's one of those Vandenhoeken Rubric books.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Made gold foil pages. Jim?
Sure. A question, Alan, here, going back to a point that I think you made probably about a half hour ago or so, but it has to do with the issue of private interpretation. It seems to me, and just this is more of a comment, actually, I guess, and asking you to comment as to whether or not I'm thinking correctly or wrongly on it. So the comment is this: it seems to me that in an imposing body which is committed to original intent, that the animus has the effect of actually preventing kind of crossed fingers subscriptionism, the idea that I can come into a body that is imposing a certain confessional standard, and I can have my own private interpretation, which is contrary to the way in which my brothers are thinking. So, for instance, I could say, oh, you affirm the Trinity. Sure, I affirm the Trinity too, while at the same time really holding to sort of an altered Socinianism or something like that. That's an extreme example, but it seems to me that the animus can actually have, within a body that's faithful, a body that is committed to the real and actual words of the confession and the original intent, et cetera, that it has a conservative effect. I don't know if that's at all accurate or if you would, spar with me on that or what.
I think you nailed it, Jim. That's precisely right. And that's one of the things that, let me just say then, following on the, I'm going to come back to that, but just to say a little something here, following then that publication in Confessional Presbyterian, the Presbytery of Northern California, which was particular in Northern California and Nevada, which was particularly in the OPC, which was particularly struggling with the issue of the duration of creation days and how to deal with that. The majority of the presbytery believing there should be some liberty along the kinds of lines stated in the report on committee view, the committee report on creation views, and a minority thinking that you're taking an exception clearly, which that language is problematic among us at any rate, but that's another matter. You're scrupling, let's just use that language. You're scrupling at Westminster if you think that what the space of 6 days means anything other than those days. They had a number of us out. John Fesco, I've mentioned him before, George Knight, John Meether, and myself. They had us out in February 2009 to talk about these things. And I talked about this, tried to set forth some of these matters. We all contributed here. The conference was on, it was called an Animus Impotentis Conference. Really exciting that a Protestant body had a conference with a Latin name. So how do you like that, Camden? So,
I think it's wonderful.
Somebody else can issue things in Latin, I guess. But at any rate.
Well, we see it's interesting here because Jim brings up the idea of subscribing ex animo, you know, without any mental reservation. But then we're also speaking about that we need to subscribe and understand what the imposing body understands. The next practical question is, how does the candidate or the gentleman know that he is indeed subscribing to what the body has understood?
Well, he obviously should be studied in this, and I think he should be properly examined and vetted.
Yes.
Before coming to the floor. I think it's the particular responsibility. In most of our presbyteries, the mechanism is a kind of gatekeeping committee that we generally call something like a candidates and credentials committee. Hmm. And this committee examines this man coming for licensure and then particularly for ordination in the standards. They should examine his understanding of subscription and so forth. But also particularly they examine him in theology in some measure before he's given that theology exam on the floor. And they should be able, they should gauge, they should know the issue so they can probe to take Jim's illustration. Is his doctrine of the Trinity sound? Is it what we believe the Trinity to be? And so both before he gets to the floor and then on the floor, all of that should be explored. There should be no question. And if the candidate has any question, it's valid and humble and properly revealing integrity for him to say, well, on this issue, or there's this expression in the confession that I'm not sure about, or I take this in this way. So he should be, because you're part of what he does, part of one of the oaths that we take is to subject ourselves to our brethren in the Lord. And part of our subjecting ourselves to our brethren in the Lord is for us as candidates, if we're a candidate, to be perfectly candid about our views, our beliefs, what we believe. And then the body itself will make a judgment is if this is in line with how we understand these things. Just a little bit back then to what Jim was saying, he's absolutely right. Because Charles Hodge, in his Church Polity, Charles Hodge exposes this whole issue for us nicely in his Church Polity, published just posthumously by his son. And Hodge is concerned about candidates who might put their own sense on the words that are propounded to them, either in the oaths or from the standards. And Hodge, I'm going to quote him here. And you'll see how it's, just as Jim said, a conservative doctrine. I'm quoting Hodge. He says, it's no less plain that the candidate, this is someone being examined for gospel ministry, has no right to put his own sense upon the words propounded to him. He has no right to select from all possible meanings which the words may bear that particular sense which suits his purpose or which he thinks will save his conscience. It's well known that this course has been openly advocated not only by the Jesuits, but by men of his generation in this country and in Europe, men of this generation. And then he goes on to talk about John Henry Cardinal Newman with respect to this. He says, men have boasted they could sign any creed. Professor Newman, just before his open apostasy, and Newman went from the Anglican Church, just reminding us all, to the Roman Catholic Church of the 19th century. He says, Newman, just before his open apostasy, published a tract in which he defended his right to be in the English Church while holding the doctrines of the Church of Rome. He claimed for himself and others the privilege of signing the 39 Articles, the Statement of Faith of the Anglican Church, in a, quote, non-natural sense. That is, in the sense which he chose to put upon the words. Hodges, that's the end of the quote. Hodges' entire argument here is that the notion of animus impenitus safeguards the integrity of the standards and does not allow one to put whatever construction he may choose upon its words. I think that's what you were saying, Jim.
That's correct.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in real quick here with a question as well. Alan, it's very interesting that you just quoted from that document, because that's actually one I was thinking about. I was going to ask, let me ask kind of a biographical question and then kind of with a follow-up comment that might illustrate the point of it. First of all, I'd like to know kind of when were you first exposed to this idea of the notion of the animus impenitentis? And I asked that because I was actually by reading this article, or at least a portion of it. It's very interesting that first time I was exposed to the animus impenitentis was in seminary, where we had to read this this piece on the system of doctrine by Hodge, which at the time I didn't realize that the version of it that I was reading was edited by Machen. It was from the Presbyterian Guardian. It was kind of a bits and pieces, I believe, from the Polity work that you are referencing, or maybe the same article that you were referencing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Machen has this published in the Presbyterian Guardian amidst a discussion, I believe, of what was going on at the time in terms of millennialism in the church. And so illustrating on the one hand, certainly the animus impenitentis is not new. It's not new in American Presbyterianism. It's not new in the OPC. So just kind of commenting on that, when you ran into this understanding of the animus impenitentis and commenting any more on the Hodge Machen OPC issue.
That's a good question of when I first saw that. It would have probably been a while back, because I would have run into it. I run into it in Hodge's Polity. I guess it didn't though. It just seemed patent to me. It didn't seem odd or anything of the sort. I mean, I here's a further biographical note for what it's worth. As an undergraduate, I was in there. This probably answers some questions some people may have about me and the work I've done in the church in terms of appeals and complaints and that sort of thing. I was a pre-law major. I was heading toward law school, and I got saved. No, I mean, no, really. the Lord made clear where he wanted me to go. So I have, for better or worse, whatever lacks I have, and I have lots of them. I have the legal mind. I just am. God has blessed me in that way to understand and deal with those kinds of issues. Lots of absolutely spectacular people, very bright people, very pastoral people, very wonderful people. Just they don't have legal minds, and they find legal concepts hard to grasp. And we do have church law. There is such a thing as that. Our Book of Discipline is an expression of that. So I know when I read this, it seemed like, yeah, of course there is this. Yes. And there's a hermeneutics not only to Scripture but to the confessions as well. So that didn't really surprise me. But it's a good question, Adam. I didn't really grip me as being as important as it's come to be in my thinking, or as I think it is, really until this controversy. So it was probably then in reading Fesco's article in Westminster Journal, it was 2001, and the committee was erected that year. The Committee on Creation Views was erected in 2001 and reported in 2004. And so Fesco's article kind of that brought that back into view for me, you might say. And other things. I mean, people on the committee, Brian Estelle, we were talking about it. Of course, Brian's a professor at Westminster, California. Lee Irons was on the committee, and I don't mention, you might say, oh boy, you should have trepidation about mentioning that name. Lee made a great contribution to the committee. I appreciated the service that Lee gave when he was on the committee. I think it's very helpful. But we talked about that as well, so there was, that sort of brought it into view, for me again, was the creation controversy, but it wasn't a new concept, but it was sort of seeing the importance of the concept, just because I just hadn't been involved so much in any issues like that. And subscription as such hasn't been an issue among the OPC like it's been even, say, among the PCA. Confidence in Our Brethren, a very good article by John Meether, previous to that, in a David Hall volume on the practice of confessional subscription. John Meether's article sort of highlighted and detailed how we go about this in the OPC. And he's picking up an old quote from Machen, who said, "We have confidence in our brethren." And we've never had an ipsum averba approach. None of American Presbyterianism in any general way really has. That means every word itself in the confession. We believe in ipsum verba of Scripture. Every word of Scripture is the word of God. I think Jim even believes that as a Barth scholar.
God's grace only kept me from going any other direction.
we attribute that to Scripture, but we don't to the confession. We believe the doctrines, but we've had a certain way of it's beyond what we're talking about here, but a certain way of dealing with this that I think has really been quite good. I think that Meether article, people should read that article. But again, I had read it before, that article, for example, and John was on the committee and he did great work on the committee, on this Creation Views committee. But that issue for me really brought into focus things like John's article and what has our approach to subscription been, and the whole question of what is the animus imponentis. And one of the things that really I found quite interesting, if I may just point this out, that speaks to this, in the report. Now we're back to the 2004 Creation Views report, and it begins on page 259 in the minutes, a section called "The Place of the Animus Imponentis in Confessional Subscription," and I would encourage people to read that if there is a good starting place if they're interested, and to sort of see how it works out in that particular issue. And it's the committee that wrote it, but I wrote this section, and you know. I mean, there were other sections with the different ones of us wrote. But one of the things that really struck me as I worked on this session was I sought to say, what has the General Assembly, what have any presbyteries ever said about creation? And we deal with that. But the question was, have we ever dealt with, in any respect, has any body ever dealt with, in any official way, the question of the duration, the length of creation days? And what came out was that the Committee on Christian Education in 1954, the committee engaged in an informal discussion about a tract on evolution by Dr. Edwin Monsma. And Monsma had brought this tract to the committee asking if the committee would publish it. And they said, well, we want to all read it before we do. We want to give everybody a chance to read it. And this is what they did, finally. They moved and carried that Dr. Monsman be informed the committee after prolonged study. And I should just pause and say this committee had some very conservative folk on it. After prolonged study and discussion of this tract on evolution, reluctantly concluded it would not be desirable for the Committee on Christian Education to publish it because of the dogmatic position taken on the controversial issue of the length of creation days. Now, Monsma in this tract took a position that the days of creation were, quote, ordinary days of 24 hours. So he is dogmatic in that sense. But the way that he set forth that view was quite ironic. He isn't dogmatic, for example, about the age of the earth. He thinks scripture is silent on that. And he summarizes his position on the length of creation days in this way. He says this, without categorically dismissing all other views that hold to something other than creation days being days of ordinary length, it does seem that this one, the day of ordinary length view, is most easily harmonized with the scriptures and with the whole of special revelation. And we say in the report, this is a rather understated way of addressing the issue and affirming one's position. Nevertheless, even though Monsma's position on the length of creation days is rather modestly stated, particularly given the discussion in recent years, some people have been quite virulent about that, the Christian Education Committee still declined to publish it on that basis. Hmm. May well reveal something of the animus impotentis on this question. Certainly, it seems to indicate that almost 20 years after the formation of the OPC, this was in 1954, the denomination remained unwilling to publish anything under its auspices that set forth the length of the creation days as being of ordinary duration. And by the way, I should say, in case anybody out there is unduly impressed that I knew this, that I was able to come up with this, I have to say this here. And I'm trying to say it without weeping quite seriously, because I was just having a discussion about this whole matter with Grace Mullen.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And Grace Mullen, to any who don't know her, she is the inimitable. And that's true in this sense. I mean, that word, she's unique, and it really applies here. Was archivist at Westminster Seminary, librarian, but archivist and also the denomination. And she said there was a Committee on Christian Education report, or the Committee on Christian Education dealt with this with respect to publishing something, as I recall, back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. She knew it off the top of her head. Mm-hmm. Now, the general secretary didn't know it, or the committee, just because he doesn't know the whole history, and nobody knew it, but Grace did. And so I was able to get all the relevant documents from her.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. She's a special person.
Yeah.
Now, Alan, historically speaking, presbyteries, as you've mentioned, have been the ones that have credentialed ministers. And so in that regard, they're the ones that are really enacting and, for lack of a better word on the top of my head right now, enforcing an animus impotentis. But at the same time, the church as a whole has been one who has adopted standards, and you would imagine that the church as a whole, through its General Assembly and the Presbyterian understanding, is the one that seems to have adopted those standards and have a certain understanding of them. How do we understand the relationship between a presbytery and the denomination, understood as a General Assembly, when we have different presbyteries that have different understandings of the animus impotentis? In fact, might have different animus impotentis. I don't know the plural of that, so we'll put it that way. Certainly, there are differences among presbyteries in terms of what's acceptable. How do we deal with that particular issue on this subject?
That's a question that just has no easy answer. I think presbyteries need to think long and hard about this. What we encourage in the report itself is we do encourage that presbyteries should not simply engage an issue like the duration of creation days or like issues that may be at controversy among us, that there may be differences among us about, that it not engage those differences only when it is examining a candidate we might say, a hapless candidate who is caught in the crossfire of potentially warring presbyters, presbyters who are disagreeing with each other, and there's the candidate in the crossfires. What we suggest here is that presbyteries engage in theological discussion, that they have colloquia and like sorts of things. In fact, the kind of thing that we did out in Northern California, and some people out there, I mean, you could talk to people in the presbytery. Some felt that it very much helped. Others, particularly who were of the view that, you know, these are 24-hour days and every other view should be excluded. We shouldn't permit any other view. They didn't necessarily find it that helpful, meaning I think that they didn't agree with our position so much. But I think ultimately, even if you check out there, things have to work through. And I think things have worked through in a way that presbytery has come to a better peace about the situation. Now, I don't want to speak out of turn, and you know, maybe members of that presbytery are listening to this who would take issue. But that's what I've heard. I only, you know what I read in the newspapers to, you know, a little Will Rogers there. But
I mean, to follow up Camden, I think, how, as Alan said, I mean, it's not an easy, there's no easy answer, but the answer seems to be kind of, at least on that issue, what the OPC did. It had the work of a committee that has communicated back and forth with presbyteries, but then, you know, the follow-up discussions after that. So
there has been that, brothers. You know, let me just say this. After the report on Federal Vision and A New Perspective on Paul, particularly, there were some men in the OP and persons in the OP who, shall we say, voluntarily realigned. They thought, well, if this is sort of where the OP is in its mind, and I understand, I don't need letters and cards telling me the General Assembly didn't adopt it. I understand all of that pretty well. I understand what the General Assembly did, but I think it was also not wrong on the part of men who may have been, they may have been Federal Visionists, to say when the Assembly did what they did with respect to that report, well, there's not a friendliness to some of my positions which get discussed in this report and are said to be outside the bounds. It is the case that, no, there weren't judicial cases being made and so forth, but there was some of this, what I'd say, voluntary realignment. Similarly, in the aftermath of the creation views, things have to be worked through. I'm actually going to name somebody, and I don't think he would be opposed to my doing so, but Ross Graham, who was then General Secretary of the Committee on Home Missions and Church Extension, had a conversation with me within 2 to 3 years after the adoption. So it was probably around 2007 or something like that. I mean, we had lots of conversations at different points, but he had a specific conversation with me in which he shared no little sense of joy. And he put it this is the way Ross put it. And Ross, of course, being the General Secretary of Home Missions, he's very signally involved with church planting, in case listeners may not know what that means, throughout the denomination, throughout the United States. So he's involved with churches being planted throughout all the presbyteries. And he said that report, that is to say the report of the Committee on Creation Views, has had a pacifying effect, has had a very salutary effect on many of the presbyteries, and has brought peace into some presbyteries where there was a great deal of trouble and stirring, and I think it's still having that effect. And he said, from my point of view, as being involved where I am in church planting, I'm just telling you what he said. He said that it may be the most important report a committee has ever given to the General Assembly, just in terms of the effect that it's having in the churches and in the presbyteries. And that was his view. But I think his view, that's an informed view, I think. I don't think he would mind me saying that. He said, I'm very, very happy with what that committee has done, and I think it's having a good effect. And we talked about how there were a few presbyteries at that time, that were, you know, they were still dealing with issues, but that this ultimately was just helping. So all this is to say is, yes, this report, and we recognize this in this report, could contribute to shaping the animus impotentis. So you're right. Presbyteries are going to have to deal with this. But now this is a resource. It's not. Now, some people have wanted to wrongly use this on both sides. Some people have wanted to say on the one side, look, the General Assembly has said everything goes in a sense. No, it didn't say that. That isn't what the report said. That's not a careful reading of the report. But the it said everything needs to be properly explained and dealt with and so forth. But it does seek to call for a peaceful coexistence of a sort. And is that mandated? Does that mean that a presbytery can't make an issue of this? No, it doesn't mean that. No, it doesn't mean a presbytery. It's not binding the presbyteries in some way. Presbyteries still, you know, on the other hand, there are some brothers who say, you know, who take a narrow view, who say, if you believe anything other than 24 hours for the 6 days, you're not welcome in the OPC. And they wanted to say, well, the report didn't really mean anything. Well, no, it isn't the case that a report made by a committee, and it was received by the General Assembly and distributed for study. So the General Assembly, though they didn't adopt it, receiving something and saying it should be studied is a way of commending it. It's a sort of low-level commending. We get very nervous about all these verbs, you know. But it is that. And so, and it wasn't rejected. There are other reports. I mean, we can look at the history of reports. There are things that the General Assembly has rejected. It's not done that too. So this is about the highest kind of thing the Assembly ever does with things.
Other than constitutional changes, I suppose.
Yeah. With a part, and this is not a constitutional change. This is a part of the Constitution. But it is to be received because the General Assembly received it. You know, it's not something to be thrown out or just used to line the birdcage with or start fires with. It really should be, you know, seriously studied. And if you're going to, and I think it carries some weight in the fact that if you look at the composition of the committee, these aren't men who all hold the same view on the duration of the days. And there are some men with rather strong views about these different positions. And yet we came to this unified report. Well, that should not mean nothing.
No, that's very insightful. And it's helpful to see this in action. We hope that this conversation has been helpful. I'm confident that it has been and that people find it interesting and insightful because we see many of these facets and many of these aspects in action day in and day out, especially as men go to presbytery and see credentialing happening and as others have debates and discussions about doctrine within the church. It's important to understand what we believe and what it means to subscribe to a confessional statement. Reverend Strange, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. We want to thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
We do want to point people to various websites so they can find folks online. You can find more information about Alan and the seminary at midamerica.edu. Wonderful school there in Dyer, Indiana, which is very close. It's still in Chicagoland, if you're wondering where that is. It's not out in the middle of nowhere. Beautiful area and easy to get to. You can find out more about them and their programs at midamerica.edu. Of course, you can find us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs as well as how to subscribe to them and all the great stuff we have lined up into the future. If you'd like to get a hold of us or give us your feedback, please email us at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us @reformedforum. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.